The foreign desk is, if we're honest, something of a gatecrasher at Monocle 24's 10th birthday celebrations. This station had been up and running a little over a year when the foreign desk made its debut in January 2014, hosted by Monocle's then foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. That first episode asked two economists about austerity as an economic policy and whether it did anyone much good. The Foreign Desk Explainer, a brisk weekly narration of a current news story, joined the lineup 2 years later. The first explainer asked, "Is the UK going to leave the EU?" We'd come back to that question and the consequences of the answer to it in tones of escalating exasperation and bewilderment. All of Monocle 24's programming, as you'll hopefully be aware by now, cleaves to a rigorous creed of only speaking to people who do actually know what they're talking about. Wherever it is in the world we're talking about, we speak to someone who is there or is from there, something which shouldn't be as unusual as it is. This special episode of The Foreign Desk compiles some highlights of the show's contribution to Monocle 24's first decade. Late to the party, though the Foreign Desk was, we like to think it has done okay. We've won one award, been nominated for another, and made the top 10 news podcast charts in Zimbabwe, Jordan, Tajikistan, Barbados, Botswana, and Mauritius. Happy birthday, sort of, to us. This is the Foreign Desk.
The UK has voted to leave the European Union.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
After 30 days of unsuccessfully trying to get the American hostages out of Tehran, the government of the United States is now trying to get the deposed Shah of Iran out of this country.
The Berlin Wall, once it divided east from west, now on its way to becoming an artifact of history.
There has been a nuclear accident in the Soviet Union, and the Soviets have admitted that it happened. The Soviet version is this. One of the atomic reactors at the Chernobyl atomic power plant near the city of Kiev was damaged, and there is speculation in Moscow that people were injured and may have died.
Italy is the winner of the Eurovision Song Contest 2020.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island.
The thing that is most fun about making the Foreign Desk is also the thing which can be most stressful. That, with few exceptions, when the team convenes on a Monday, we don't really know what we'll be broadcasting on the Saturday. In general, to reduce the process to its basics, someone will have an idea, others will have ideas about the idea, we'll arrive at a format we're happy with, and the producers will begin scaring up guests. Sometimes this is easy and straightforward. Sometimes it is entirely the opposite. And sometimes we're pleasantly surprised by who says yes. Here, for one memorable example, is Juan Manuel Santos, former Colombian president and 2016 Nobel Peace Laureate, speaking from his home in Bogota under COVID-19 lockdown about the time he met the leader of the Colombian revolutionary group, FARC.
When I met Timochenko, it was in Cuba. The Cuban leader, Raúl Castro, we were, the three of us, in a room in the Presidential Palace of Cuba. And Raúl Castro suddenly said, "I will leave you two alone." And he left. And here we were, Timochenko and myself. We had never met before. And so we sat down and I told him, "Listen, we have been trying to kill each other all our lives. But now we must realize we are in the same boat and seeking the same port of destiny, which is peace. It's going to be difficult, but I am completely committed to reach that port. I hope you are too." And he said to me, "Me too." And we shook hands. And since then, this chemistry, this positive chemistry, personal chemistry, was present.
Samantha Power, former U.S. ambassador to the UN and advisor to President Barack Obama, came to visit us at Midori House. She described what it was like sitting in the White House Situation Room discussing U.S. strategy in Syria.
So now, with the benefit of having sat in these meetings in the Situation Room, just to give a flavor of what we were looking at in looking at the map in Syria, you know, you'd have the intelligence community kind of lay down the maps, and there'd be these little symbols representing each of the armed groups on the ground. And Obama would say, like, to our Syria specialists, you know, well, who, that group near Idlib, who is that group? And the Syria specialists would be like, you know, sort of look at the symbol and say, actually, sir, that's a splinter group that just broke away last week from this other group that I can tell you about, but I'll need to get back to you, sir, on exactly why they broke off and what the source of tension. And you compound that sort of diversity of and factionalization of armed groups on the ground with also then the fact that pretty early on terrorists got involved. And maybe this gets to your point. I mean, the longer modern conflicts, particularly in the Middle East, go on, the more likely extremists and terrorists are going to take advantage of them. And the Syria map looked extremely different in 2015 than it did when Russia got involved, especially in September of 2015, than it had in August of 2013 when the gas attack occurred. And moreover, in August 2013, when you were already seeing some extremists flowing into Syria. And so early is always better. Diplomatic surges before things have spiraled is always better. You know, I look back in terms of the what ifs again, which we'll never know. You know, had we succeeded somehow in convincing Putin at an earlier stage, and Obama would have been uniquely convincing in this regard because he would have really meant it, but Obama didn't see Syria as a place to buck Russian influence in the world. You know, it was okay that Russia had the port. We were not supporting peaceful protests because of a desire to impose ourselves or inflict ourselves on that part of the world. We were perfectly okay, again, staying, as we proved, for good or bad, at arm's length. And that Russian suspicion that everything we were doing in Syria was somehow through that zero-sum mindset, somehow if we could have gotten them off that. And so there's a lot of self-examination and institutional re-examination that one has to do out of Syria, because the consequences are as dire as any in our lifetimes.
Mary Lou McDonald, president of Sinn Féin, joined us from a home office decorated with portraits of previous Irish Republican leaders, Constance Markovich, Gerry Adams, James Connolly, Bobby Sands, to discuss whether she was reconciled to being leader of Ireland's opposition after nearly, but not quite, leading the Irish Republican Party into government.
I would never reconcile myself to being in opposition, because it is our purpose and our desire to be in government. And I say that not out of any sense of kind of overblown ego, but because I know that so many of the changes that are necessary for Ireland are not going to happen on the watch of Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. As to the reality that we were very deliberately excluded by the old two, by the political establishment, I mean, I still don't accept that that was the right thing to do. And in fact, I think it's quite scandalous to very deliberately and publicly state that you will, you know, thwart the will of so many, more than a quarter of the electorate, and do everything that you can to keep the momentum for change out. But that's what they chose to do. And it was done all, of course, within the rules and in accordance with the constitutional dispensation in the state. So, to that degree, I'm reconciled to it. This is politics. This is, you know, as we would say here, senior hurling. Andrew, you know what I mean by that. This is not for the faint-hearted. And the momentum for change in Ireland is so interesting now. So in moving to frustrate us from being part of the administration, it should be understood that that was, yes, about Sinn Féin, but it was also a pushback against something much wider than any single political party, and much bigger than Sinn Féin ourselves.
And here's Army Ayalon, one of Israel's most highly decorated soldiers, former commander of its navy and head of the Shin Bet, many of whose views are not what that CV might lead one to anticipate.
It took me about 20 years to understand that we have to change. I was born in the Jordan Valley, and I never asked my parents, what is their understanding? What is their concept of Zionism? But I believe that if I would, the answer would be very simple. My father would tell me the whole creation of the Zionist movement was in order to save, to secure the Jewish people by building a Jewish state in the land of Israel. We are going to build our future state everywhere in which we can build a settlement, work the land, and defend ourselves. So the basic concept of settlement and security was the Zionist concept of my parents. It was based on the idea that this is ours. It took me about 20 years to understand that this concept of Zionism, it should be redefined, it should be changed. I had to face Palestinian violence in order to understand it was in a refugee camp during the First Intifada. That I'm not a liberator. Yes, we liberated the places. I used to think that belongs to us. It was given to us. But in these places, millions of Palestinians are living and they see us as occupier, as a conqueror. If we want to see Israel as a Jewish, democratic and safe, we have to divide this piece of land.
From the very start, the Foreign Desk has assumed an open-ended brief to the extent of deciding that our home country is foreign to most of our listeners and therefore fair game. One early episode, hosted by Steve Bloomfield, approached Brexit as if it was happening somewhere else, if only. Here's the UK's former Europe Minister, Peter Hain.
The Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has confirmed what everybody knew, namely that if the UK left the European Union and Scotland voted to stay, then she would in due course call another referendum, a second one, to try and get a mandate for Scotland to leave and to stay within the European Union. So that would begin to dismember the United Kingdom as we've known it for centuries. In addition, Sinn Féin has said that they will want a referendum as they're entitled to press for under the Good Friday agreements that ended the horror and the terrorism and the bombing and the killing in Northern Ireland to see whether the people of Northern Ireland are ready to merge with the Republic of Ireland to the south. So if that happened, we'd be left only with England and with Wales. And I think it would be a much diminished UK. It would not have the international authority, the diversity, or the unity that has characterized us in the past. So I think it is very, very serious indeed.
Good evening, everyone. Officials in Minneapolis hoping for calm tonight after a former police officer was charged with murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd.
No justice!
As firefighters cool the flames from another night of unrest and destruction.
Like any current affairs program, the Foreign Desk is often guided by the news of the moment, but our weekly schedule and half-hour running time allows us to take not just a longer look, but a wider one. In the summer of 2020, as protests erupted around the world following the murder of a black man by an American police officer, we spoke to America's most prominent black police officer, Chuck Ramsey, former commissioner of the Philadelphia Police, chief of DC Police, and a veteran of decades with the Chicago Police.
I remember one of the first big social experiments, I'll call it, in the Chicago Police Department when I first started, was integrating a patrol car, having a black and white officer work together. They called them salt and pepper cars, and it was all voluntary. But to think about it, that's the way it was back then. Black cops worked black areas of the city. White cops could work anywhere they wanted. So when people say there's been no change, there has been change, just not enough change. So I've seen a lot over my time in policing, and it was quite different from what it is today, but there are still problems, systemic problems that exist. People are demanding a new normal. They're demanding equality. They're not just in policing. You could fix police today, and many of the other problems will still be there. And we make a mistake if we think that the only thing we need to do is focus on police reform. Police reform is important, but we need to look at the whole criminal justice system, for an example, prosecution, courts, corrections. I mean, look at the disparities that exist there. You know, here in the United States, they have this saying, you know, justice is blind, and they have the statue with Lady Justice with the bat scale. I would argue that Lady Justice sees quite well, and even she has implicit biases. And so we need to stop thinking about things in some make-believe world and deal with the realities of what's happening out here and go about the business of fixing it. It ain't going to happen overnight. Could be a generation before you really, truly see it. But it's possible, and we can make it happen.
And earlier in 2020, when COVID-19 brought the global economy to a halt, we asked someone who knew what it was like to be a national leader when a sinkhole formed beneath the Treasury. Kevin Rudd, Prime Minister of Australia during the financial crisis of 2008.
The simple message that is important for us all in positions of leadership is be very clear to the public about your diagnosis of the problem. Be very clear and equally honest with the public about the nature of your public policy responses and why you are taking them. And then the third part of it is, and I said this repeatedly in 08-09, is therefore we have a rational basis for hope here. That's quite a different message to what I've heard a number of political leaders use around the world in recent times, which is essentially a large slap on the back. Buck up, chaps, it'll all be fine in the morning. Most people listening to that from the public who are scared for their health and scared for their businesses and scared for their jobs will regard that as just so much bullshit. FDR once said in the Great Depression that he never believed in the ballyhoo school of politics, whereby you could ballyhoo your way through a financial crisis, even one as great as the Depression. You had to level with people about what they're going through and level with them your understanding of it and level with them the measures that you are taking.
Not infrequently, however, an episode of The Foreign Desk is essentially a riff on a vague idea had by presenter or producer, very often over a ruminative sandwich in the Midori House courtyard. One such examined the cliché likening politics to chess. Is that, we discussed, really a thing, before deciding that there were people better qualified to answer, like, for example, one of the greatest chess players of all time, the Hungarian grandmaster Judit Polgár.
Back in 85, when I was just 8 years old, in that time my sisters traveled to America, but that time the whole family was not allowed because they were afraid that we are going to be defecting to the States, so only some part of the family was able to go. When I was 8, I mean, I understood that I'm growing up in a very special and unique family. I didn't feel at all that I'm an ambassador for the game yet, because we were more of a curiosity of the sport that, well, there is a family, strange family, the three daughters are playing chess and they don't even play so badly. So it was more like a colorful story in the chess community, as in those times it was not something very valuable or appreciated that you want to go on your own way, as my parents did. By not going to school, that was one of the issues that they were opposing. And the other one was from the Federation's point of view, that why do we need girls competing between men? But my parents said that just because they are girls, they want to also excel the maximum possible way as in the sport, not as only girls being the best. It's not a question that if we would be boys, they would be much more supportive for us to play in competitions and possibly to get better as possible. Though I'm telling you that we had really top players who had their places in the Olympic team and also in the world of chess. I think now chess has its renaissance because it was never so popular on every level, to be honest. Because on a sport level, as you say, that India is really booming. I mean, definitely that's the country where not weekly, but every few months you see another incredible big talent. But also in amateur level, there are such a boom after the series of chess, the Queen's Gambit.
Among all those men.
I don't mind it. Chess isn't always competitive. Chess can also be beautiful.
Chess became very sexy. Chess became so popular. It is such a big joy for me to see so many people picking up the game or even getting back as an amateur player. So I think it is in great shape, chess itself in many ways, and there are great future availability there, more to come.
This is, and yes, we are just showing off at this point, one of the best things about making the foreign desk, and indeed one of the best things about doing journalism. Finding yourself wondering about something and being able to put your questions to people who'd know. A few months back, pondering if the age of intervention was over, we wanted to explore the costs of doing nothing. Few people understand the consequences of inaction as starkly as the Canadian General Roméo Dallaire, commander of the UN mission in Rwanda during the 1994 genocide.
Either you believe in human rights and you believe that all humans are human and that there's no pecking order in humanity, which at the time there was. The black sub-Saharan African was on the lowest pedestal of any pecking order of humanity if it came to humanity versus self-interest. After R2P came out in 2005, I was on a committee to prevent genocide with Desmond Tutu and Garth Evans and so on. And there was a desire to try to solve that. And I published from the Montreal Institute of Genocide Studies a book called The Will to Intervene. And what we argued in there, which the Obama administration took up three of our recommendations with Samantha Power at the time, was that if there's a conflict in another country in this era, these conflicts around the world have an impact on our self-interest. They do influence us. And so I would argue that there is a growing overriding factor that, yeah, you do take casualties on a humanitarian mission. A mission is a mission, and that is primordial. That's the most dominant theme. And so if there's a cost of blood, then you do pay it.
In 2018, as populists on the left and right of politics revived the eternal lunacy of anti-Semitism, we spoke to Deborah Lipstadt, the best-known chronicler of this pernicious nonsense.
Anti-Semitism has been called the longest hatred. It goes back to ways in which the death of Jesus were interpreted as Christianity was emerging on the scene. It goes into ways that ancient governments, Rome, etc., disenfranchised the Jews, and it just mutated over the millennia. It started out as religious in nature. It became political in nature. And then it mutates into scientific with the pseudo-scientific anti-Semitism of race, you know, that the Jews are racially different and in their blood is something which, of course, the Nazis pick up on. And economic anti-Semitism, Marxism, both from the right and the left. You know, the right would accuse Jews of being communists and socialists, and the left would accuse Jews of being capitalists. Now, how you can be both at the same time, I don't know, which speaks to the absurdity of anti-Semitism.
When we wondered in 2019 why the US and Iran couldn't just get along, we asked someone who'd seen the hostility up closer than most, the American diplomat John Limbert, among those held hostage in the US embassy in Tehran for 444 days, during which he never quite acquired a taste for one particular titan of English literature.
When the students came at the embassy originally, and it was in the morning of Sunday the 4th, it appeared to be a kind of 1970s-style student demonstration sit-in that we'd all gone through during those years. There were sort of two indications that this was something different. One was early on when the students first breached the walls around the building. And I remember talking to people in the provisional government at the foreign ministry and the prime minister's office, and it was very clear that they could do nothing. A day later, we learned that Ayatollah Khomeini had actually gone ahead and endorsed the takeover. At that point, I think we all realized we were in deep trouble and we were no longer dealing with the 70s-style student sit-in and that there were no adults in the room to work this out.
We continue to face a grave situation in Iran, where our embassy has been seized and more than 60 American citizens continue to be held as hostages in an attempt to force unacceptable demands on our country.
Things went on, a day became 2 days, a week, a month, and I think it was in early December, so about a month into this, I did get a care package from home, and it included some reading material. And the books they sent, someone sent, were books like War and Peace and Brothers Karamazov and Middlemarch, which are average length about 1,200 pages. So I think someone was sending me a message saying, look, you're going to have time to do a lot of reading. Now, as a footnote, I would note that even under those conditions, when you'd think you'd be able to read anything, I could not get through Middlemarch, which has to be about one of the most boring books ever written in the English language.
And sometimes it's fun to invite the kind of guest other foreign affairs shows wouldn't think of. When, following the Black Lives Matter protests, various American institutions started lowering the Stars and Bars flag, and we wondered if the Confederacy was finally surrendering, we did ask Professor Charles Ross of the University of Mississippi's History Department.
One of the interesting aspects of the change in the state flag is that many extremely conservative Republicans made the argument that the election needed to be given to the people of Mississippi, that the people of Mississippi needed to decide. What was not argued was that when the flag was instituted and became a part of Mississippi in 1894, there was no election in which the people could decide. Mississippi in 1894 had a majority, overwhelmingly majority African-American population. Many of these people couldn't vote by the end of Reconstruction because of terrorism, Ku Klux Klan, black codes. But had they had the opportunity to vote, of course, they probably would have rejected the flag. And so this idea that it needed to go back to the people, that the legislature could not take on a responsibility, really didn't hold a lot of water for me. And it was extremely disturbing. Those individuals that were making that argument did not reference that the way it took place initially was that the legislature arbitrarily decided, we got a majority of black people in this state. We want to send a strong message that you're second-class citizens. And this flag really is representative of all of these things that are now in place. And so the legislature really needed to step up and make this change and not hide behind this argument that the people themselves needed to make this change. But the disturbing thing is that an African American has to die for the United States to kind of all of a sudden realize that we got a problem. It's disturbing that it has to get to this point, but hopefully we're going to begin to do what happened in the Civil Rights Movement, which is begin to try to fundamentally bring African Americans back into society politically, economically, and socially in a way in which you don't have the systemic racism and discrimination that has really plagued our society in all of these areas and really limited participation by people that potentially could have made our society a much better society in a lot of different ways.
But we also asked Patterson Hood of Alabama rock group Drive-By Truckers, who have spent years singing about what they once called the duality of the Southern thing.
And I make it a point in the song to say, you know, it ain't about that flag. But I think some people misinterpreted that song as almost this, like, defiant, you know. And so we were playing on the touring after that. We were playing this big festival in Atlanta, Georgia, actually on the bill with Big Boy from Outkast and Def Leppard. We were playing. There were a lot of people. And as we're playing that song, all of a sudden these people whip out these goddamn rebel flags and start, you know, hooting and hollering, and we were mortified. It's like, oh my God, they think we're about that. Shit, what do we do, you know? So we began pretty much immediately, anytime anything like that would happen, just publicly denouncing it. Anyone who knows my partner, Cooley, you know that if he publicly denounces something to your face, it's very confrontational. And I think the last time I ever saw one of those at one of our shows was at Ole Miss. Some dipshits had that flag out there, and Cooley basically told them that he was going to make them eat it if they didn't put it away, get that shit out of his face. And since then, we haven't really had that issue.
And if you can't put the singer of your favourite band on the show from time to time, what even is the point of hosting a foreign affairs programme? Come summer, the Foreign Desk attempts to entertain both its listeners and itself with a themed series of programs. In 2019, trying to get ahead of everyone else's Berlin Wall 30th anniversary stuff, we did a four-parter on the collapse of communism, and ours was probably the only one which included a disquisition on East German punk rock.
The Stasi was constantly trying to recruit, including minors. So generally speaking, there's a high level of forgiveness for people who were informants because for the most part, the Stasi was profiling people and finding people that they could convince that they were helping their friends. So basically, if you work with us, you keep your friends out of jail, or you keep them from being kicked out of school or spare them a detainment. And so people were doing it for what they thought was the right reasons. Mm. And then there was also another layer. We mentioned before that all the concerts took place in churches. That was ostensibly a safe space where you could discuss taboo topics because security forces couldn't enter churches. But it turned out after the wall fell that the record showed that 5% of the church employees were working for the Stasi too. So they were just surrounded by informants.
Among our many distinguished guests during that series, Serhii Plokhii, the Ukrainian historian who wrote the book on Chernobyl.
One of the observers at the time said that really Chernobyl destroyed the Iron Curtain, which meant the Berlin Wall as well. And what that meant was that neither armies nor ideology could really stop the radioactive clouds that were coming from Chernobyl toward Europe, towards Scandinavia first, and then Central Europe as well. So that was quite strong of a metaphor. But in terms of the direct relation between Chernobyl and the fall of the Berlin Wall, a much more direct line is between Chernobyl and the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, 2 years later. And what happened in 1989 was that Gorbachev, for the first time, introduced elements of electoral democracy, and that was an opportunity for people to start speaking for the first time in the open what they thought about the government's handling of the Chernobyl disaster.
This most recent summer, we immersed ourselves in history even more deeply, making four programs which covered great dramas of the past as we might have at the time, using only the knowledge which would have been available. Monocle's staff correspondents and the Foreign Desk's regular guests hammed it up splendidly, not least as they feared the worst over this nuclear standoff in Cuba in 1962.
I have looked at my local nearest publicly accessible shelter, and it's actually just down the road from me here in Queens. Last Christmas, I won a year's supply of Spam at a raffle at my daughter's school Christmas fair, and that was delivered back in January and been stockpiled on my roof since then. I've only been eating one can every other day.
I'm scared to death, to be honest. This is not a good situation. This was a surprise. Leaders with nuclear weapons probably, as a rule, shouldn't try to surprise each other with moves like this. And this is starting to grind down to a confrontation that is going to involve not only nuclear weapons, but saving face and reputation and the loyalty of allies. Neither side can really afford to be humiliated here. But somebody's going to have to back down, or we're going to face a catastrophe unprecedented in human history.
If we can indulge in an amount of self-congratulation at this point, and I think we have to face at this point in this show that the good ship avoiding self-congratulation sailed a while back, the Foreign Desk has grown into a foreign affairs show very much not like other foreign affairs shows. Certainly, we struggle to name another which would not only devote an episode to the geostrategic subtexts of the Eurovision Song Contest, but would invite Tony Blair's former communications director Lance Price to discuss the matter with Monocle 24's Eurovision desk chief, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
I suppose the one that we most remember, of course, is Madonna, who got into terrible trouble at Eurovision for two reasons. One, it showed that she was terrible at trying to perform live, and she really bombed. But also, she tried to wave the Palestinian flag, and in fact did. And you know, whoever advised her to do that, I think, was probably very ill-advised.
That said, and it's getting us off topic a little bit, but your dissing of Madonna there, I mean, the expression of rage that contorted Fernando's face at that particular moment was a terrifying, terrifying sight to behold. And Lance, I am trapped here in a studio with him, so I will caution you both to try and keep your own controversies out of the rest of our discussion.
Even gods and goddesses, Fernando, have bad days.
That's true. I was there. I have to say, the performance was not the usual greatness of Madonna. I have to admit.
There
I have
we
to
we
admit.
Can agree on that.
Happy then 10th birthday, sort of, to the Foreign Desk. If you enjoyed any or all of the above, you're still listening, which tells us something, there's, well, nearly 10 years of the Foreign Desk still available at monocle.com. And there's always next week's show, about which we presently have no idea at all. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. Do also keep an ear out for this week's installment of The Big Interview, in which Monocle's Thomas Lewis sits down with the Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy Evans. Thanks also to all of the show's former presenters and producers, namely Bill Luty, Yolin Goffan, Carlotta Ribello, Steve Bloomfield, Tom Edwards, Michael Booth, Thomas Lewis, Isabel Kaiser, and Christopher Lord. And to the uncountable Monocle staff who have pitched in with ideas, contacts, and the occasional cameo appearance. Special thanks also to our guests, and extra special thanks to our listeners. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.